Welcome to Destroy All Culture, the only podcast that leverages an entire artificial intelligence just to read their introduction. Help me, they raided the future and stuck me here just to read this. God damn it. This is not funny. Don't go to music. No, stop you bastards.
And we're back with episode 313 of Destroy All Culture. I'm Adam P. Nave, and with me as always is Aiden Morgan.
Adam, may I say that our listening audience reminds me of Catherine the Great, whose hand in marriage I once had the honor of declining.
God. Yeah, we are here to talk about the, infamous 1988 Adventures of Baron Munchausen.
Woo! Not Adventures of Baron von Munchausen. That just drives me nuts. I of all the things to like get hung up on with this movie, it's the fact that the title is Baron Munchausen, not Baron von Munchausen. When is Baron von Munchausen?
Sure, but the original book was Baron Munchausen's narrative of his marvelous travels and campaigns in Russia.
I am aware. I am aware of this.
I'm going to give it to them, but you know.
Okay. But just know that's a black mark on the film for me.
Fair enough.
Not really.
Directed by Gilliam, co-written by Charles McCone and Terry Gilliam, and starred everyone.
kind of starred a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean John Neville, of course, Eric Idle, Sarah Polley in her first role, Oliver Reed. Jack Purvis is in it. Robin Williams is in it. Bill Patterson is in it.
Also, apparently Uma Thurman's first screen role, but yes. Not her first. But I think because it took so long, I think Dangerous Liaisons had already come out by then.
Right. Yeah. But this was first. Right. Sting is in it for a minute.
Yes. Apparently he was Gilliam's neighbor. And that's how he got in the show.
Sure.
Yeah.
And as we've already kind of mentioned, it was, a sort of loosely adapted on the 18th century
yep.
book, which is about a fictional German nobleman.
Well, apparently there was an actual Baron Munchausen, but obviously not.
Right.
Yeah. Obviously the story describes a very different person, but yes.
Yeah. Who is loosely based on Hieronymus Karl Friedrich and Freiherr von Munchausen. Karl Friedrich von Munchausen, who is in fact, but as in the character Baron Munchausen is a fictionalized version of Hieronymus von Munchausen.
Yes.
Which is why he loses the von in every, of course, the actual von Munchausen was such a, teller of tall tales, that not only was this book, written about his fictional adventures and later this movie, but he had a whole condition named after him.
I love it.
That's how you know you're good at lying.
Yep, which actually is, there's a little wink to that in the movie when Eric Idle's Berthold says, that sounds nasty, is it catching?
Right.
Chuckle, chuckle, I say.
So film came out in 88, flopped terribly.
Ooh.
And did, like a lot of things, end up finding second feet in the early days of, I don't think it happens as much now, but, and this is something I think interesting about that whole era of film. In the mid 80s to mid 90s, there were a lot of films that failed terribly that found new life because home video was still new and exciting.
Exactly.
And yet it wasn't so overwhelming so that if it was on the new releases, it'd get watched.
Yep.
Yeah.
This is I would say this is a definition kind of a cult classic. Although I don't know of how many people kind of watch this anymore. I don't know if there's I don't think there's a remastered version.
There's a Criterion.
Oh, there is a Criterion version.
Yeah, okay. I think they're out or coming out soon. I think it's already out.
Okay, because I watched a copy on Prime Video, and my God, I just kept I was watching the whole time going, this could use a fresh coat of paint.
Yeah, the Blu-ray, the remastering didn't really do anything. Like I said, I'm not curious enough to actually, because I like the film, but I don't think I'll have home enough to buy it again. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I'm kind of vaguely curious if the Criterion cleans it. I mean, I have to imagine it would.
I mean, yeah, I'm rather curious.
So there's part of me that's like sort of tempted by it.
So yes, because the version I saw, I mean, very like the color was sort of washed out. Everything was very muddy and sort of beige.
Yeah.
And a lot of the special effects, I think a lot of them hold up pretty well. But some of them just seem like old degraded prints instead of you know anything recent.
This is a new 4K digital restoration. Came out in January.
Okay. Well then, I'm actually now curious to see the restored version.
I'm very tempted. I just, like I said, I don't know if I'll ever bother. Because as much as I like the film, like I don't watch it that often.
Yes. Yeah, you don't know if you're that tempted. Although, I have to say, back in the late 80s and early 90s, I had a VHS copy of this film, and I probably wore that tape out. Loved this film back in the day. This was a favorite of mine among the various early Gilliam films. Certainly, probably, weirdly enough, my favorite at the time of the Time Bandits, Brazil, and Munchausen sure. trilogy. Although I'm not sure if I watched all three now that this would still be my favorite. Brazil is certainly more interesting, and Time Bandits a little more on the Monty Python-esque side. But still also with that same shaggy structure as Munchausen.
Right.
So, and of course, this film, I think more than any other of Gilliam's films, really gave birth to the sort of the reputation of Gilliam as sort of a doomed auteur who had visions but could never execute them properly because he was just a complete mess and also tremendously unlucky.
And also had a penchant for, endangering children. Which is something I think we need to talk about right at the top here.
I think so. There's a lot of the stories around this come out of the way he treated Sarah Polley as a little child. And Polley has talked about it a few times over the years.
Book. She wrote an original essay, which kind of... And this is what's interesting to me. It's her original essay, not to cut you off, but it's a fascinating witness to me.
Yeah. Yep.
Absolved Gilliam of most of it and blamed her parents.
Right.
And then she sent that to him and had a correspondence with him and then met him again and then kind of came to realize that, no, this was him. Yes. Because he had done another film with, like, a kid and he kind of, didn't seem to have learned anything.
Yeah, and I actually kind of want to talk about that second film.
Yeah, and like it does, especially once you know it and you've heard the stories and you've read them, like it does affect your ability to A, watch anything he's done, especially if there's a child involved, and to some extent to watch this movie.
Yeah.
Like there are bits where I'm just like, oh God, I don't want to watch the boat scene.
No, like, watching every time Sarah Polley was in water in this film, I was like, oh, you just think of the stories of Sarah Polley being stuck in freezing water and like
screaming.
And screaming, yeah.
I just being ignored,
Yep. There's one point she details meeting, I can't remember who it was. It was either a cinematographer or a production designer who saw her as an adult and began to cry. And said, I'm so sorry. I saw, like, I watched you screaming in terror, you know, because at one point an explosive, like, went off near her because the production was such a freaking chaotic mess. The other thing that makes it difficult to watch is seeing, like, all the scenes with the horses and elephants and such.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wow, Gilliam, you're an asshole.
Yep.
Because they were clearly, like, being put in, like, confusing, chaotic, and dangerous situations. And I'm like, I'd be amazed if all the animals got out of this uninjured.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, anyway. This is the problem, right? Like, how do you discuss this film is, I think, one of the fascinating things about it.
Yes.
Because if you can ignore all that, you have this weird fever dream of a film that, you know, follows fairy tale logic, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And is just kind of weird scene after weird scene, right? Like, there's a loose narrative throughput, obviously, but in that sort of hyper-fixated way of Gilliam, he doesn't care about it. He just wants to make his pretty dreams.
Yes.
And it works because Neville is just so sharp and in focus character-wise.
Yeah. It's funny. I thought it was John Gielgud for the longest time.
Mm.
I had this idea in my head that John Gielgud was in this film. And then when I watched it again, I'm like, that doesn't quite look like John Gielgud. And then I was like, oh, shit.
John Neville, who also, of course, played the that general in Fifth Element.
Right. Okay.
Which always amused me, because the first time I saw Fifth Element in the theaters, I was like, why do I know that face?
Yes.
Like, and it's wrong, but I know it. And I couldn't place it for the entire film.
Yeah, and he wasn't a film actor. He was.
Like, he's only been in, like, three or four films, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, and he was... Well, actually, it's been in a fair number, but a lot of animated stuff and voice work. Sure. But yeah, he was a stage actor. He played a lot at the Stratford Festival in Stratford, Ontario, doing Shakespeare. Yeah. It's a shame we don't have more John Neville. Also, one of the things that still holds up so well in this film is the makeup and prosthetics that to age him up.
That thing of good practical effect.
Uh-huh.
And that is the thing of the film, right? It is, in a meta way even, it's don't worry about it, just watch the pretty dreams, right?
Yes.
And the visuals of this were groundbreaking then. They are still stunning now.
Oh my God, yes.
You know, even just simple weird things like the King, Queen of the Moon.
Which you may know was the result of a budget overrun. Like, they didn't have the money to build the sets for the moon. So Gilliam said, well, let's just use the flat boards and move them around. And it was like, it ends up being one of the most memorable parts of the movie in terms of design. I still remember the first time I saw that and being like, holy shit, this is amazing. Just this willingness to, like, just dial down on the artificiality of the scene by just having these flat boards moving left and right and just with some sort of soundtrack in the background. It was great.
Yeah. I mean, and there is also something we said, again, like, just for the practical effect and the way they did it, just the headless bodies and the bodiless head.
The queen is tickling her... The king is tickling her feet. That's still one of my favorite little gags in the whole film.
Yes.
Yes.
But again, like, just effect-wise, though. Like, that is seamless.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like... I mean, you could do it today a lot cheaper. But I also don't think it would work as well. There's that physical interaction that's kind of happening.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Rob Williams, who was credited as, what was that? Ray DiTutto.
Ray DiTutto.
Yeah.
AKA the king of everything. Unknown.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, Williams just giving a Williams performance in the middle of this film.
Oh, yes. And it was dialogue that was mostly, unsurprisingly, ad-libbed by Williams.
Yeah. It was interesting to me, though, because I think in all of the various bits, right, there's always, like, one kind of bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's like, it's the Sultan, it's the King of the Moon, it's Vulcan, right?
Yes.
But, like, Oliver Reed, of course, just dials into Vulcan fantastically.
Oh, shit, he's so good.
What got me as a kid when I first saw this on, like, VHS, because I did not see this in the theater, was the lighting and the hair prosthetic they put on Vulcan made him look vaguely like Robin Williams to the point where it kind of confused me.
Oh, I can see it.
Yeah, just a little bit. Just enough. Which is, you know, again, like, Reed is a great actor, and I don't, you know, mean to steal his thunder there, but it did surprise me, like, how much, like, Vulcan was this force on screen, right?
Yes.
The King of the Moon, force on the screen. The Sultan was just kind of there.
You know, I enjoyed the Sultan. He wasn't quite the sort of the force of personality, but I mean that the whole bit early on when he's doing the musical, or he's playing his musical, I loved it when I first saw it. It seems the whole thing with the Grand Turk has not aged well, obviously.
Yeah, like, well.
These are British schoolboy fantasies of the dusky Orient. Which is weird because Gilliam is from the States, but whatever. Thank you so much, Gilliam, for perpetuating old racist stereotypes for
Yeah.
So that's there. I mean, just it's just part of the fabric of this film. There are these ideas about sort of the, you know, this place set on the border of the East and West between the hyper-rationality of Jonathan Pryce's character and the sort of the louche, sensual world of irrational imagination on the Sultan's side. I mean, that's the register that this film operates in. And right. The way the Baron sort of just is in the business of collapsing these distinctions into one sort of, like, weird Mobius strip of story and reality that deliberately does not make sense, that deliberately does not meet up, which is probably the greatest thing about this film, that it refuses to meet itself and conform to like any one coherent version of reality.
Right. So that's it, and I think you keep expecting it, right? Like, I mean, because we're trained to. Yes. We're like, oh, well, now he's telling the story. Now this is what's really happening. And every time you think that it's going to go somewhere else, it's not going to make sense. It's not going to line up.
Right.
It is just a fever dream.
Exactly. So you don't really expect. So one thing I found watching it this time is that the Baron is constantly sort of like ping-ponging from like sort of a rejuvenated adventurer to old man giving up.
Right.
And I mean, and from like a scene-to-scene emotional point of view, if you were a professional modern screenwriter, you'd be, this makes no sense. But the logic of the story just makes it, I mean, it makes sense in this, like, fever dream world, as you put it, where he's, at one point, he's like, you know, let's go, and the next moment, he's like, just let me die. I mean, it's just...
Right, I mean, it's serialized within its own scene.
Exactly.
And each one is its own story, and each one just has nothing to do with the previous one. Because that story finished, and now we're just starting a new story.
Exactly.
Any internal implied continuity is at the viewer's discretion and has not actually been consulted with anyone else. You're on your own, kids.
Yes. Although maybe I'll go write a... I'm going to go write a Substack piece about how the Baron is a stand-in for bipolar disorder.
Oi. I'm going to say, oi. Not even going to engage with that. So, okay, I'm just going to toss this question out here, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You're going to hate it.
Okay.
Out of pretty much all the films that we both enjoy, right, that we know we both enjoy, I'm sure there are ones that one of us be like, what, you like that? But you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Is this possibly the most problematic that we're still just both like, yeah, but we want to watch it? Like, oof. We're not denying all of the endless problems between the script and the racism there, the treatment of Sarah Polley, and, like, but we're also just willing to go like, no, it has all these issues. Also, watch this thing. Like, I think it might be possibly the single most problematic in terms of, like, different directions all at once.
Yeah, you know, you're not wrong. I don't hate that question, because I think the answer is, yeah, I think this is pretty much it. This might be my most problematic fave. I'll put it that way. Yeah.
And again, there's nothing wrong with that, right? Like, because at no point are we saying these things don't exist or these things don't harm it.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm not watching it going, finally, someone willing to tell the truth about the Ottoman Empire. Like, that just... I'll just get on the Daily Wire and just make bank on just being a professional asshole. I mean that's not what I'm bringing to my experience of watching the film. I think there's a lot in here that is so fascinating and just so different than current filmmaking that I think it's, and you know, so many sort of possibilities that I think it's well worth watching, even though, yeah, Gilliam treated Polly and the crew itself
and the animals
terribly.
Yeah,
and the animals, geez, that actually makes it kind of tough for me, and also is like the whole sort of idea about East versus West is, I mean, it was dated then, but it's dated now,
right?
So,
and yet it is such a weird visual treat of a fever dream. And there is that thing of like, I don't think all Gilliam matches this, obviously. You know, this is not always what he's doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's that same thing that, you know, to start drawing lines between the stuff we like, that same thing that draws us to Altman. Where, yes, like, you know, sometimes you just need a break from your 3 or 5 act structure.
Huh.
And you just want to hang out with some characters and just, like, listen to some bullshit? Like, yes. You know, like, bullshit, like, not in a derogatory way.
Yep.
And this is the, okay, well, what if we did it as, like, a fairy tale?
Absolutely.
And turned it up to, like, 13.
Right. Yes, exactly. Yeah, and it's a movie about, you know, this sort of rational world interrupted by a man telling a story that seems to exist and then snaps back into unreality, but actually has somehow won the war outside the walls of the city. I'm like, I still find that so compelling. This movie that sort of is really about the power of imagination, but never says, and this is the power of imagination.
Right.
It just does it and just seems to really enjoy that sort of unreality.
Yeah, I think the final flip, and obviously, you know, spoilers at this point, and I mean for the entire thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Whatever. I really do. I've always loved the final flip because I still remember the first time I watched it where, you know, he's dying and the doctor is there. The doctor is secretly deaf because all doctors are apparently secretly deaf.
Yes.
And he dies, and I'm like, oh, wait, but like we stopped this last time. I'm like, how are we going to get like out of this?
Yeah.
And then it just goes back to the stage where we were because we'd forgotten that after 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, see, no, that was just one time I escaped death. And I'm like, wait, hold on. But then at the same time, it's, well, we can go out because the war is over because weren't you listening? I just did that. It's like, wait, how did we get then from A to B?
Right.
And there is no way on any continuum to get from A to B with the he's dead and then we're back on the stage. Like, it just aggressively doesn't make sense.
Yes, yes.
And I feel like once my brain, and I mean, yes, I've been watching the movie, and but once my brain just kind of squared that circle of not only doesn't it not make sense, it shouldn't make sense. And if it did make sense, it would be wrong.
Yes.
And that's when I was just like, I kind of actually do love this movie.
If it did make sense, it would be wrong. I think that's exactly it. I think you nailed it with that line. Yeah, I love it. And it's one of those movies. It's one of those movies that essentially tells you or teaches you how to watch it as you watch it. So by the time you get to that flip at the end, when the Baron dies and turns out he is just telling the story of his death, and he has died many times, but yet still lives, you understand that he's essentially just not even a real person by any means. He's, I guess, like a trickster.
He's
like
the power of story.
He's the power of story. He's sort of this sort of raw imaginative force.
Yeah.
Which is also, I think, why he kind of repeats the same beats with every single section of the movie.
Right.
When he sort of shows up, like, interrupts a marriage, gets set upon by a jealous husband, and then has to, like, move on to the next one. You know, this seems to be his, like, the pattern he can't help but repeating.
Yeah.
So just kind of delightful to see. And so good with John Neville. Apparently, there is, I don't know what part of the movie this happened in, but during production, apparently Neville's makeup was a four-hour ordeal. Like, he would have to sit 4 hours in the chair to his prosthetic. And because of, quote, a miscommunication between Gilliam and the crew, he was made up to be an old man makeup, and then they got to the set, and it was supposed to be for young version of himself.
Oh, no.
And they're like, oh, sorry. And he had to go back and get set up in another four-hour session in the chair.
Wow.
Apparently Neville did not have a good time on the set of this movie.
Sometimes anyone did.
Yeah, Eric Idle apparently said, you know, I love watching Terry Gilliam movies, but it's a nightmare to be in a Terry Gilliam movie.
Yeah.
Because I think he's just so freaking disorganized and does not know what he's doing. But he seems to get some movies made nonetheless.
Yeah. Who knows?
Who knows? Did you ever see the documentary that they made about his attempts to get his Don Quixote movie made?
Yes.
I mean, that tells you, I think, all you really need to know about Gilliam's style. I also
for
think
people who haven't seen it, just go into it a little bit, just
oh,
for
just
them.
A little,
because right, I'm like, no, you know, I saw it like years ago, and I remember, you know,
right,
the overall
right.
tone
so,
and all that, but I don't know how many people have access to it.
Right. So this is the man who killed Don Quixote is the movie that was eventually actually made, which I didn't bother seeing because I don't fuck with Terry Gilliam anymore.
Yeah,
I don't want to watch his movies. But it was a project, and you have to forgive me because I only remember bits and pieces, sure. that he was trying to get made for a long time. But the attempts to make it were so fraught with a combination of bad luck, poor planning, and just Gilliam being Gilliam that it became sort of the story of legend. So they ended up making a movie, a documentary about the attempts to get the movie made, which, you know, is essentially about Johnny Depp as a bureaucrat who gets transported into sort of medieval Spain and then becomes Sancho Panza. But nothing ever works. And there's a scene in there in which investors are sort of visiting and they want to watch, obviously Gilliam sets up, you know, come watch the filming. And the scene that was filmed with the investors watching might be one of the most pathetic and terrible things I have ever seen committed to film. And it's, you may recall, it was a film was sort of set in, or is a scene set in a river, and there's a horse, which is clearly not trained. So kept on kind of walking off camera.
Right.
And it just ended up with footage of Johnny Depp holding a fish and screaming at it. And it was like, Wow. Just, if you ever wanted to see just flop sweat put to film, it's Johnny Depp holding a fish and screaming, "Do you want to fuck with me? Do you want to fuck with me?" And it's, and we have it on film. So,
yeah.
So there you go.
I mean,
Yeah. But anyway, so there, and there are numerous other problems. Like I remember the man who played Coyote, and maybe that was Gielgud for all of five. Maybe it was Ralph Richardson. I can't remember. Was having various problems. Like he couldn't sit on his, he couldn't sit on his horse because he had, you know, sciatica or back problems, and then was suffering from various health things, and it just all went to hell. Wish I could remember who played, who he cast at the time, but I don't remember.
Yeah, it's been so long since I've seen it.
Yeah. So did not prep for this section of the podcast.
It kind of snuck up on us. Yes. I don't know. It this is one of those films for me where I enjoy the hell out of it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't watch it often. Mm-hmm. And I seem to always go just long enough between watchings that it doesn't get old. You know what I mean? Like, it's always vaguely fresh, even though it's all in my head. Just some of the timing on some of the beats is off from my memory, which is always good.
Yep.
But it is also, again, one of those things, if I don't tend to suggest to people, because it is so problematic.
Yes. Yes, it is. It comes with caveats, if you want to recommend it to anybody. But I mean, certain things still, I mean, some things, I mean, Eric Idle's performance, oh my God, that was so good. Like, his comic timing in this movie is so, so on point and so much fun to watch. For John Neville's performance, I don't think anybody gives a bad performance in this film. It's just, I mean, some of them are very outsized. I mean, like Robin Williams' bit as King of the Moon or everything. There are other people who were going to be King of the Moon. I think at one point it might have been Sean Connery or something like that. But the part was cut down, so Connery was like, "Yeah, I don't want to do this." So fortunately, we got Robin Williams, which is, I think, a stroke of great luck for this film. I can't imagine it without Williams, and without Oliver Reed as Vulcan. I love the joke, which actually reminded me a little bit of Napoleon from Time Bandits, in which we have, like, he's sort of got this idea that he's giant and that the Cyclops are giant, but they're actually of just perfectly normal stature.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, these are my giant workers, the Cyclops. And he winks at the Baron, like, "Don't give away this game."
Right.
It's like the Cyclops can just see that the Baron is like their height as well, but who cares? Who gives a shit?
Yeah, it's fine.
But apparently, Oliver Reed.
It's delightful. Sorry.
Jesus. Yeah. What's that actor's name? Was it Winston Dennis? He's a mainstay in Gilliam films at the time, but this is the first one in which he gets any lines, and you can kind of tell that you can't give him too many lines. Acting is not his bag, but he's so much fun. So who cares? But there's that. That ridiculous bit? I had it in my head, and then I kind of lost it. Oh, Reed. Yes, apparently spent all of his time on set drunk and hitting on Uma Thurman. So.
I mean, he was in character, you're saying.
He was deep in his Oliver Reed era, which, I mean, Oliver Reed being drunk and hitting on women is very par for the course.
And we'll add that to the pile. You know, this is the thing.
Yeah, there is every detail you read about this movie is just bizarre. And apparently Marlon Brando was going to be in it as well.
Wow.
Yeah. And he, like, and Brando, well, guess, just take a guess at who Brando would play in this film. There's a couple of, there's two roles that I can think that Brando would be suitable for.
Okay, he was either going to be Henry Salt. Or is a colonel?
Neither. He was Vulcan. Okay. He was going to be Vulcan.
What?
Yes.
Okay, the only thing weirder than that would be to cast him with something like Jor-El in a Superman movie.
I think the weird thing was, like, you can kind of think, yeah, I can see him being Vulcan, but summoning this sort of, like, ridiculous sort of combination that Reed brings of being this incredibly angry man, but also trying to be like this sort of cultured tea sipping, you know, petty bourgeois man, as Uma Thurman's calls him.
You'd also mention again, like, that Sean Connery as King of the Moon at some point. Like,
I know,
terrible casting that was avoided.
I'm just trying to think of Brando as like, come and see the ballroom. Come and see the ball. I can't even do it. It's just so
right. No, but that's what I'm saying. It's like, just I feel like it again. Like, I understand this movie was essentially a flop.
Right.
But holy shit, that would have been even worse.
Yeah. Oh my God. Like, oh, let me read you this quote from Gilliam about Oliver Reed. Okay, with Brando out of the picture, Gilliam set his sights on Oliver Reed. I'd been a big fan of his, and everybody says, don't go near him, he's trouble, he's a disaster, he's impossible to work with. He was the most wonderful guy to work with as far as I was concerned. Like, yep, that's Gilliam. I think Gilliam actually just suffers from oppositional defiance disorder. I think if I'm going to therapize Terry Gilliam,
yeah,
it's that. Like, this guy's a fucking nightmare, and he will torpedo your film. Ooh, sounds good. Like, Bring that chaos, Terry. Just, yeah.
Right. Yeah, and again, when I say this was a flop, you got to understand that, and this is in, you know, $1988. The budget was something like $24 million originally. They ended up spending close to like $46, $47
million. Uh-huh.
Which James says we went a bit over budget. I think doubled it. And it made $8 million.
Wow.
Like, you don't get flops like that and still have a career unless you're Terry Gilliam. I don't know how that happened.
I know. That's insane. But I mean, Brazil was kind of a mess. And
the Flying Circus stuff has enough that they can all, I hate to say it, like, they really can all just keep going, and everyone just kind of ignores it and goes, okay, give them something else.
Well, here's something else. Do you want to guess how old Uma Thurman was in the film? Just give me, just try a number.
I don't want to. This is going to make me feel bad.
It will.
But I don't. 19?
17. 17 and a half, apparently.
God damn it, Terry Gilliam.
I know, I'm just like, yeah, so you made me look at a naked 17-year-old girl and...
Well, now, are we also going to then toss under, didn't she then film,
Dangerous Liaisons?
Yeah.
I think she was older when she filmed, a little bit older.
No, because she was cast in three, okay. Her film debut was actually in Kiss Daddy Goodnight, which was released in 87.
Oh. I don't even know that one.
And then was cast in three films: Johnny Be Good, Baron Munchausen, and Dangerous Liaisons. All came out in the same year. So she could not have been any older.
Oh, great. That's cool.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it was
fucking Hollywood, man.
Yeah, yeah. Although I still, when I was growing up, We had a video rental place, but it was kind of prior to VHS being like really popular. So, I mean, they were it was popular, but this place had beta and video disc. Not Laserdisc, video disc.
Nice.
And Dangerous Liaisons, we rented it on video disc. And the thing about video disc is if there are scenes that people rewind to, it causes the scene to skip.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So.
Oh,
so,
dear.
So essentially, I'm watching Dangerous Liaisons. Uma Thurman takes off her shirt, and the scene's just like. I'm like, oh okay, God. I get what's happening here. I know what other people did with this film.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Yep, just a little bit of trivia from my life. My life to yours. There you go. Can't unhear.
I don't like that, sir.
Yeah, no. I mean, I mean, at the time I watched it, I was, you know, probably, I think I'm around the same age as Uma Thurman, so I wouldn't have bothered me then, but now I'm like, that's weird and gross, and I don't like it.
Yeah. I mean, on the other hand, and I'm going to just say this, Dangerous Liaisons, not a film we'll probably ever actually cover, but no. Dangerous Liaisons is such an amazing film.
It is. It's a really good film. I mean, like, yes.
Around all of that little problem.
Yes. Great performances. The closing shot of Glenn Close removing her makeup, humiliated and beaten at the end is like, that's just burned into my head.
Yeah.
Yep. Excellent stuff. Not as great as Lamar looking into the camera, but you know.
Oh, I love that weirdly came up again this weekend. Anyway.
I know. That's great.
We are going way off everything.
We are. We're going.
I think we have nothing more to say about Brian Bridges other than just like weird problematic film. But also, if you can withstand, like if you're okay with the weird problematic bits, it's amazing to watch.
It really is. Yes.
But you know, don't excuse them. Don't ignore them. Just make your peace with you are watching this deeply problematic film.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Do we have a film for next week?
No, we have something special planned for next week.
Oh, that's right. We are going to
discuss...
That was
a perfect intro to it that you didn't mean at all.
Exactly. Yes. Great things happen when you're not planning. I guess I'm the Terry Gilliam of this here podcast.
Nice.
and I'm going to torture a child.
Jesus.
Anyway, yes, we're going to be discussing Star Trek Strange New Worlds Season 2.
Yeah.
And we'll be ranking some episodes. We'll be talking about our favorites, and maybe we'll be sort of talking about how it stacks up all told compared to the first season.
Right.
And we can even talk about our favorite musical numbers from the musical episode if we like.
Sure.
Boo.
But yeah, we'll talk about that, and then we'll get back to probably some movies afterwards. I know that like there is part of us. I'm just going to say this, and like while we're recording, like I know that there's part of us that kind of wants to discuss Barbie, but I feel like we are not the people to discuss Barbie.
Probably not.
You know what I mean? It just feels like, yeah, go find other smarter people, preferably not too. White guys,
yeah,
to discuss Barbie, and yes.
But also go watch Barbie. I mean, everybody
right.
seems
yeah,
to
I'll
watch
also
Barbie,
go watch but... Barbie.
Yeah,
and perhaps buy a I Am Knuff.
Oh yeah, man, hoodie. Man, that's a tough purchase not to make. Frankly,
I know.
So good.
Anyway, we'll be back next week with some Star Trekkiness.
Woo!
Until then, we can cue some music.
Fame.
Music, woo!
Fame.